He's going up, and yeah,
yeah, on the mark.
A cover. One, two, and no. No, not quite.
What about that, Ross? Does that ever get on your nerves? How McMahon always says, one, two, he got no.
Huh? Well, he almost got him.
Well, yeah, gonna be repetitive, creative.
I miss Vince McMahon's commentary. That was a clip from WWE's new Best of In Your House DVD. I'm only a few matches into it. Really enjoying it so far. And they even dusted off Todd Pettengill. They brought back Pettengill to host the DVD. He was... Yeah, Todd was goofy back in the day, but I liked him. He was a morning radio show host here in New York. Still is, actually. This is episode 273, I should say, of the Solid Monster Sounds Off here on SEScoops.com. It is Sunday, May 12th, 2013. Did you know that the first In Your House pay-per-view took place on Mother's Day back in 1995, almost 20 years ago? It's just impossible for me to believe. On that note, I want to take a moment to wish all the moms listening a very happy Mother's Day. I do hope if you are listening to this, you're doing so of your own volition and not because your son downloaded the Sound Off as your Mother's Day present. That would be grounds for disowning them. Don't forget, you can also listen to the Sound Off now through Stitcher, Radio On Demand. Type in Solid Monster Sounds Off, and all the latest shows are available for streaming via Stitcher. Want to take a moment to talk about my latest LayfieldReport.com column, which should be up by the time you read this. I'll put links up to it on Facebook and Twitter. Again, I'm not sure if the links are yet showing up again on the main page. I know they're working on that. Column I did this week focuses on the late Owen Hart. Owen Hart would have celebrated a birthday this past week on Tuesday, May 7th. As a matter of fact, Owen would have turned 48 years old. Of course, Owen died after an accident at the Over the Edge pay-per-view back in May of 1999. And a lot of times I think people associate Owen, you know, with what happened to him and his death, which did take place in the month of May. But they don't realize that he actually was born in the month of May. And it was a tweet that was posted by his brother Brett mentioning that really kind of jogged my memory in the fact that Owen Hart would have been 48 years old. He was 34 when he passed away, which is just far too young for anybody to lose a life. And basically just the nature of the column is remembering the kind of person that Owen was and just kind of recapping an experience that I had with him. I had an opportunity to meet Owen for the first and only time less than a year before he died. It was actually at a live Raw show that I had won tickets to from a local radio station. We were in a luxury box, and this would have been in the summer of 1998, back when Owen was still part of the Nation. And Owen was one of four superstars, including Mick Foley, Mark Henry, and the late Luna Vachon, that WWE sent to many of the luxury boxes in the hour before Raw went on the air to do kind of a meet and greet with the fans, sign autographs, take pictures, and just generally converse for a few minutes. So I talk a little bit about that, meeting Owen, what a nice guy he was, at least to me and to us. And by all accounts, that's the kind of person that he was, and it's a shame he's no longer with us. So just a column recapping that whole experience and just remembering the man that Owen Hart was. And as I mentioned at the end of the column, litigation between WWE and his wife, his estate, ceased recently. There was some sort of agreement that was reached. I think both sides agreed to pay their own legal fees, and that is done. It is over with. It has opened up hope in the minds of some, perhaps, that this could pave the way for a Hall of Fame induction for Owen. I'm not sure that this really changes that whole situation much. His wife, still not a fan of wrestling. She never was a fan of wrestling, let alone the McMahons and WWE. I don't know that you're suddenly going to have her cooperation or her approval. They certainly don't need her approval if they wanted to put him in the Hall of Fame. It would just look very, very bad. If it was not something that she wanted. And I sense that there probably is still bad blood there. So, unfortunately, I'm not really sure that has changed much. But you never know. You know, perhaps it does open the door for them to do something in the near future. And I'd like to see that. It's not necessary. Owen's legacy stands fine on its own. But it would just be a nice thing, I think, for the fans if Owen was able to get that sort of recognition at some point. So check out that LayfieldReport.com column. It should be up by the time you listen to this. And let me know what you think. And also on Facebook, I will share a photo from that fateful day. I talk about in the column being fascinated by the conversation that was taking place between Owen and Mick Foley, who was one of the other superstars WWE sent into our luxury box. And I have a great photo of me kind of sandwiched in between them as they were signing and conversing with each other. So I'll probably put that up on Facebook. But check it out if you have a few minutes. Dolph Ziggler suffered a concussion at the SmackDown tapings this past week. There was a whole story about it on WWE.com. And Ziggler apparently suffered the injury when he interfered in the Biggie Langston-Jack Swagger match on Friday's show. They had a quote from WWE physician Dr. Michael Sampson saying that Ziggler was injured in the early part of the match after a blow to the face. He said Ziggler was having some memory difficulties and a bit of a headache, but he definitely has a concussion. And WWE had a follow-up story, an actual interview with Ziggler talking about what happened. Apparently he suffered retrograde amnesia because he has no memory of a period of time between Monday and Tuesday. Ziggler did an interview. He says, "I didn't even remember Monday until I watched Raw when I got home. I don't even remember traveling from Raw to SmackDown. I don't remember Tuesday. I remember AJ and Big E taking me to the airport on Wednesday morning. I was told I interfered in a match and tried to get my hands on a ladder. When I bent over to grab it, Jack Swagger kicked me in the head." Swagger apparently has a rep for being very stiff, which was on full display Monday night. Anybody who saw Raw and the way that Swagger was just manhandling people with that ladder, you know, what he did to Ricardo and then swinging it at Ziggler's head. He threw it over at Alberto Del Rio. The guy was a madman in there with that ladder, but to not remember an entire day, that's pretty scary stuff right there. And it begs the question here, what happens going forward? Because until Ziggler can pass WWE's impact testing, which is the testing they have for concussions, he will not be cleared to return to the ring, and of course he is the World Heavyweight Champion. They do have a pay-per-view coming up 1 week from today, Extreme Rules. What was supposed to be a triple threat match involving Ziggler, Swagger, and Del Rio, and is still set as such, may well be changed. WWE is supposedly preparing backup plans for Extreme Rules. I don't know what that would be. We'll find out on Raw Monday night, I'm sure. Perhaps a number one contenders match would make the most sense between Swagger and Del Rio. It's not a match that really does much to inspire me, but these are extenuating circumstances. You know, if they want to still do a ladder match, because it is Extreme Rules, every match, I guess, has to have a stip, so they could still do a ladder match, and instead of the belt hanging from the ceiling, I guess they could maybe do a contract deal hanging from the ceiling, and the winner who grabs the contract gets the title shot against Ziggler when he's ready to come back, I suppose. I guess, again, we'll wait and see what they do on television this week. But, you know, you read what Ziggler is saying in that interview about how he, you know, the memory problems, he had a really bad headache, now he only has a minor headache. All I can think of whenever I hear about concussions like this is Chris Nowinski, and it scares the hell out of me because, you know, Nowinski, I don't know how far Nowinski would have gone in WWE if he would have been a big star, if he would have been a mid-carder for life. You know, he was a talented guy, he was on Tough Enough, he certainly had the Harvard Chris douchebag gimmick down pat, so he would have been a fine heel. But his career was cut way too short because of at least one, if not a series of concussions that he suffered, and he had some very bad symptoms from that as a result. He had to retire, and then, of course, Nowinski went to do what he does now, which is the institute that he works for, and he's doing a lot of good things now, both in wrestling and sports in general. The Sports Legacy Institute, I believe, is the name of it. And that's all well and good, and maybe that was his calling, and he's doing good things now. But, again, it scares me when I hear about injuries like this. And the last thing anybody wants, I think, is for somebody like Dolph Ziggler, who has worked very hard, finally became the World Heavyweight Champion, seemed to be, you know, climbing a little bit higher and a little bit higher in the company, and then for something like this to sideline him for any length of time, because really bad concussions, I mean, you could be out for months. Or he could show up at TV this week and get the all clear, and he could be at the pay-per-view next weekend. You know, there's really no way of knowing. So we'll just have to see what the results, I guess, of his follow-up tests this week indicate, and that'll determine whether or not he's going to be on the pay-per-view. Speaking of Dr. Samson, I noticed that Jerry the King Lawler will be making his first in-ring appearance since his heart attack last September. He'll be wrestling on an indie show May 25th, teaming up with Dory Funk Jr. You know, Funk makes Lawler look like a young rookie. Funk is 72 years old. Lawler is only 63. But I bring this up because it's raising questions I see online about whether Lawler should be wrestling. Does this mean he's going to also come back and wrestle in WWE? My take is this. If Lawler wants to wrestle, it's all he knows, seems to love it, has fun doing it. If his doctor says it's okay, then I say let him wrestle. Let him wrestle on all the indie shows he wants. WWE is a different matter. You know, when we spoke with Dr. Samson over WrestleMania weekend, he told us he was planning to wait until the one-year anniversary of Lawler's heart attack before he evaluated him for a possible return. That would be this September at the earliest before WWE would let him wrestle. So take that for what it's worth. I don't think WWE will let him wrestle again on their shows because it's just too much of a liability for them. But he wouldn't even be cleared for another 4 months if that even happens. If I'm Lawler, I just leave well enough alone as far as WWE is concerned. You know, I know he likes wrestling more than he does announcing, but he's got a really good gig, a really high-paying gig, just to show up once a week, sit between Michael Cole and JBL, you know, call some matches, make some jokes. You know, he got his WrestleMania match a few years ago. Maybe it wasn't the match he was hoping for. It really wasn't a great match. But still, he got his WrestleMania moment. He wrestled Michael Cole. In fact, if you go back to 2011, Lawler was featured quite a bit in the ring. In fact, I think he wrestled something like 4 pay-per-views in a row. He got like 4 pay-per-view payoffs consecutively. He had those matches with The Miz. He had the feud with Michael Cole. I think there was a mixed tag match with him and JR against Cole and Jack Swagger. For like 4 months straight, it was the Jerry Lawler show on WWE television. I don't know what else there is for him to do in WWE. I think he's pretty much done everything he's going to do at this point. I say just stick to the indies, wrestle every now and then, and just leave well enough alone. You have nothing left to accomplish, nothing left to prove. Lawler can be very valuable if they want to use him in angles and stuff. He can have like a shoving match with somebody. He can still cut a promo with the best of them. There's a lot of things you can do with Jerry Lawler. He doesn't actually have to wrestle. I mentioned on Twitter this week, at Solomonster, that 14 years ago this week, on May 10th, 1999 to be exact, Raw scored its largest cable rating ever, a monstrous 8.1 number. The breakdown was 7.8 for the first hour, 8.4 for the second hour, with a 9.2 overrun. Just sick numbers, even for that time when wrestling was on fire. Well, when WWE was on fire. Nitro was already starting to pretty much fizzle out at that point. I still have the newspaper clipping. I have no idea where it is, but there was a clipping in a newspaper I cut out from the New York Daily News about Raw getting the 8.1. I mean, that's how big of a deal it was. You know, that's how popular wrestling was. They actually covered stuff like that. And yes, it is true the reason WWE scored a record number that night was because Nitro was preempted by the NBA playoffs, although Raw was still doing consistent numbers in the sixes by that point. But it caught my attention because Raw this week was down to a 2.9 rating. And much as it was that night back in 99, it was also up against NBA playoff basketball, which didn't seem to hurt it much back then, but it did hurt them this week. I thought it would be fun just to take a few moments here just to look at the results of that show from May 10th, 1999, what made it so special, and just think about how it stacks up to the Raw show that we get today here in 2013. So if you'll indulge me here for a moment, I just want to zip through this here. Now, I remember this show. I remember watching this show. I remember this being a really fun night, largely because Shawn Michaels was on the show. Shawn Michaels was the commissioner of the WWF at that time, and he made rare appearances. It wasn't like HBK was on television every single week. You know, we're so accustomed to these general manager figures or whatever arbitrary titles they want to give you. I don't even know what Vicky's title is anymore. Managing supervisor, I think. I don't know. But we're so used to seeing these people on television every single week. I think a lot of people, especially newer fans, don't realize that back then the commissioner or the president, remember Jack Tunney was the president, very seldomly would they make appearances on TV. And when they did, it was usually a big deal. So Shawn Michaels was all over the show. I mean, he was just, he had his claws in everything this week. And at the time, the big feud going on in WWF was this feud between the union and the corporate ministry. Now, back then, that was probably an easy way to get people really excited about wrestling. You had two warring factions. And back then, there were so many factions. This kind of goes back to 97, not so much 99. I mean, at one point, you had the Nation of Domination. You had Los Boricuas, you had DOA, you had the Truth Commission. A lot of them bored me, quite frankly. The Boricuas, the Truth Commission, the Country Boys on Bikes. Boring as shit, as far as I'm concerned. But you had compelling ones like the Hart Foundation. Of course, WCW had the NWO. So here, the big war was between the union and the corporate ministry. And what I found just completely hilarious about the union had as its leader Vince McMahon. Vince McMahon was a member of the union, which is just hilarious on so many levels. But they came out to start the show. They had some security guards all dressed up in riot gear with them. Eventually, Shane McMahon came out on stage with the corporate ministry, Undertaker, APA, and I think Triple H was part of it as well. So Shawn Michaels interrupted this whole little powwow here. He popped up on the Titantron in what turned out to be a pre-taped segment, as we would find out, and started out the show by making a whole bunch of matches for the night. In fact, the big main event on this show, which probably goes to why the show did so well, was a six-man tag or eight-man tag? This was an eight-man tag with Steve Austin, The Rock, and Vince McMahon against The Undertaker, Triple H, and Shane McMahon. That's a hell of a main event right there. That was a lot of star power, which is one of the things I think that's really missing from wrestling today is star power. You look at the star power they had back then compared to the star power you have now, it's like night and day. What real major stars do you have in wrestling right now? You have John Cena, who by default is the biggest star, and half the people, maybe more than half the people, hate his guts. You have CM Punk, who's also gone now, for how long, we don't know. You have, Sheamus? I don't look at Sheamus as a big-time star. Big Show? Okay, Big Show's still one of those stars from yesteryear. You could throw Big Show in there. Chris Jericho? Could put him in there as well. Brock Lesnar, although he's part-time. The Rock, we don't even know if The Rock's going to be back. Kane? I guess you could throw Kane in there. Who else? There's not a whole lot. But back then, boy, you had Austin, you had Rock, you had Taker, you had Kane, Big Show, Triple H, Jericho, Mankind. Probably a few people I'm even forgetting. And even the mid-carders. The mid-carders even felt special. Everybody had their own identity. They had their own character. The Godfather would come out and people would do his whole spiel about getting on the Ho train. The Outlaws came out. People popped for their entrance. Road Dogg did his deal on the microphone. Val Venus would come out every week. And even Val Venus would get huge reactions and he would do his little deal, hello ladies and all that. I think that's something that's really missing from the product now. It just doesn't feel like we have any major stars. A lot of them are gone. They're retired or they're in TNA. They're not doing well in TNA either. But anyway, back to this. So Shawn made that main event. He also announced that there would be a lumberjack match between Farouk and Bradshaw, who were tag team partners, of course, in the APA. So that was kind of interesting. He was putting the two partners against each other. And the proviso there was that the lumberjacks were going to be members of the union. So that was going to make for an interesting match. He made a nightstick match between Test and the Big Boss Man, two men who unfortunately are no longer with us. Pat Patterson and Gerald Briscoe, the Stooges, would face the Mean Street Posse. Remember, they were from the mean streets of Greenwich. And that would be a loser leaves the WWF match. So the losing team would go bye-bye. They would disappear. Ken Shamrock against China was another match that Michaels made. Big Show against Paul Bearer. So you aren't going to get any Matt classics here, but these were interesting matches in that Shawn just didn't give a shit, and he was making matches that the fans wanted to see. Cactus Jack was going to face Midian and Viscera in a handicap match. Sable and Deborah were going to meet in an evening gown match for the Women's Championship, which, as it turned out to be Sable's last appearance in WWE. Of course, now she's married to Brock Lesnar. And then the big main event. So that was the Raw card. And one of the mass security guards turned out to be Shawn Michaels, so as he cut a promo on the Titantron, he was actually in the ring the entire time. When you look at the card, it's interesting, because back then, wrestling was fun. And this show obviously did very well. But if you're looking for a show that has long, great matches, you're looking in the wrong place. When I think of 1998-99, WWF, primarily, wrestling was not the strong suit. It wasn't about the wrestling. It was about the characters. It was about the blood and the violence and the sex and the TNA, no pun intended, all that stuff. Crash TV, You know, Vince Russo, I guess, at his best, if you want to look at it that way. That's what it was. That's what people were interested in. The hardcore title, the 24/7 rule, all that stuff. You look up and down this card here. I mean, the Big Show and Paul Bearer, if you could even call it a match, they were in there for about 3 minutes. I think the longest match on this entire episode of Raw was 8 minutes long, and it was a mid-card match between Jeff Jarrett and Val Venus. Even the main event, that big six-man tag, went, I don't even think it went 5 minutes. Test and the Big Boss Man, they went 7. So I guess that they would take second place. Cactus Jack beat Viscera and Midian. Again, under 5 minutes in a handicap match. But people were into it. They were into seeing Cactus Jack. You know, he wasn't around a lot back then. Bradshaw and Farouk wrestled to a no contest in the Lumberjack match. It went all of 2 minutes as people interfered in that match. What I remember from this night of all these things is Patterson and Briscoe. They came out to Hulk Hogan's Real American theme song, which I'm a huge mark for. So they came out to Real American. They beat Rodney and Pete Gass of the Mean Street Posse in about 2 minutes, sent them packing. I remember after the match, and this is something that's hard to kind of scrub from your brain, Patterson was posing to the Real American theme. He took his shirt off, which, again, is unfortunately the sort of thing you don't forget. And he's doing all the poses. And I remember Jim Ross on commentary saying, you know, like, hey guys, or hey gentlemen, you know, he's single. And Lawler flipped out. So I remember that. I don't know why, but I do. The main event was, again, 4 minute match, but you see all those guys in the ring together. Austin, Rock, Undertaker, Triple H. It's just, that's what the Attitude Era was. You know, those guys represented the Attitude Era. They represented what made wrestling so much fun back then. And Shawn Michaels was the guest referee for the match. I think at the end of the show, he and Austin cracked open some beers. I mean, that was essentially Raw. Basically, that gives you a quick overview of what that show is all about. If you're looking for wrestling, you're looking in the wrong place. But what they were doing back then worked. People wanted to see it. It was fun. They would sell out the buildings every week. You'd see signs all over the place. You know, when you put Raw on these days and you compare it to a lot of those Raw shows from back then, the signs are what jump out to me. Back then, everybody had a sign. And I'm sure if you were in the building, it was probably annoying as all hell. If you were sitting behind somebody with a sign that they were holding up all night, you probably wanted to wring their neck. But you would put the show on and be like, wow. You would just see a sea of signs everywhere. And now, it's the complete opposite. Now all you hear about is, you know, God forbid you bring a sign that WWE finds controversial, they're going to take it away from you. You know, there was a story I read recently where somebody went to a Raw event. I don't remember what the sign said. Actually, it was either a sign or a t-shirt they were wearing. It wasn't obscene or offensive in any way. I think it might have had, it had some wrestling phrase on it that I guess was non-WWE related. And the security guard came over and he was harassing this guy and telling him, listen, you got to move your seat. We'll move you to a different part of the arena. I mean, this is what goes on now. Back then, you rarely would hear about that. That's just how things are, unfortunately, these days. But again, you look at the two eras and you ask yourself, is PG really to blame? You know, Raw getting sixes and sevens and eights back then, and now it's down to twos and threes, and wrestling is so much less popular now than it was, you know, 10, 12, 14 years ago. Is it really a PG thing? You know, maybe a tiny bit. And I only say that because there were things you would see on the show back then in terms of sex and stuff like that that you wouldn't see now. But the PG thing that people keep, you know, railing about, it's such a crutch. You know, it really, in the grand scheme of things, it has very little to do with PG. Because you can have a PG show and still push the envelope and give people something exciting that they want to tune in and watch. The biggest reason, I think, is no competition. TNA is not real competition to WWE. Probably never will be, although we're going to get to that as far as how that might be possible. We're going to get to that in the mailbag. But there's no WCW around these days to compete with, which always makes things more exciting for the fans. And it motivates all companies involved to do better, to stay ahead of their competition. There's no room for complacency. You know, there's no room to get lazy. When there's nobody around that you're competing with, you may get lazy. You may rest on your laurels and just keep doing the same shit over and over again. And only when people stop watching your show do you kind of realize, oh shit, maybe we ought to change what we're doing here. So no competition is the biggest reason why wrestling is kind of in the shitter these days compared to how it used to be. And everything is relative. I say in the shitter, but they're still making money hand over fist. But you don't feel the same buzz when it comes to wrestling that it had back then. There's got to be a reason why. And I think that's one of the biggest reasons. Also, WWE is a public company now, which means they have to answer to shareholders. You know, they went public later that summer, actually. And I want to say August of 99 is when they went public. You got a wellness policy now. Back then, there was no such policy. And believe me, things are better off now for having a wellness policy. Because you had guys during that whole Monday Night War era, a lot of them aren't even around anymore. And the ones who are, some are in pretty rough shape because all bets were off. Anything went back then. And in the long run, that probably doesn't work out too well for the wrestlers. But there was no wellness policy. People were doing shit all the time. People were probably coming to those tapings drugged up all the time. Feeling pretty good. I mean, God knows what these guys were doing. I think guys like Road Dogg and X-Pac and the DX guys would talk about how they would come to the shows and they would smoke and they would do all the, you know, the things that people would do back then. People were having their heads bashed in weekly with steel chairs, and it was great for the fans because it looked good and it sounded cool. And then you look at the internet and social media. You had the internet back then, but it was nothing like it is today. Especially, you know, you got Facebook, you've got Twitter, all that stuff. That changed the game. So did the growth of the TV universe. Today you've got so many more channels available than you did back then. Everyone's got hundreds of choices about what you could watch on a Monday night. You also have a little something now called DVR, which didn't exist back then. So if you really want to make a laundry list of all the reasons why things are so much different now, perhaps worse off now than they were back then, you have to put all those things on the list. You can't just pin it on one thing, but all of those things have an effect. You know, we're never going to see numbers like that again. I'm convinced of that. There's no way you ever get back to that level. Those numbers were fake in a lot of ways. They really were. Those numbers were an aberration. You know, it was like a fantasy. Eventually, you have to wake up from it. But the other thing I want to mention here also is, when I look at the main event back then, during the Attitude Era and during the Monday Night Wars, all those main event guys, Austin, Rock, Triple H, Undertaker, all of them, they were full of, and I hate to use this word because it's kind of redundant, but they were full of attitude. You know, yeah, you had a DX out there, they would joke and they would screw around, but even they knew when to get serious. You know, Austin was always pissed off. I think Steve Austin was born pissed off. Undertaker always was kind of pissed off. Rock had an attitude. Triple H had an attitude. Big Show. Shawn Michaels. Christ, I mean, go back even further to when Shawn Michaels was the champion in 1996. He'd throw tantrums all the time in real life, but his character had an attitude. His character had an edge about him that would come out during a lot of his matches. Bret Hart spent much of 1997 bitching about stuff on television. You just didn't have this comedy nonsense and monologues that we have these days with guys like John Cena and Sheamus. I think that aspect is sorely missing. Nobody gets pissed off about anything anymore. Except for Brock Lesnar. And he's believable in the role. Problem is, he's only around part-time. What about everybody else? John Cena loses the championship. He's back on television the next night. No big deal. He'll be right back out there like it never even happened. We saw the same thing with Sheamus after he lost the world title to The Big Show. It comes out on Raw the next night. He's smiling. He gets on the microphone. I lost the title. No big deal. Brock Lesnar destroys Triple H's office on Raw Monday night, which actually was my favorite part of the show. Triple H's reaction? No big deal. My real office is in the ring. I'll just replace that one. No biggie. I mean, that I think is what's missing from wrestling these days. We just need more people to get pissed off. We want to know that they care. We want to know that the shit that we're seeing on television actually means something, and it's going to have an effect on people, and not just be brushed off like it's a waste of time. But the biggest thing also, everyone just seemed to be having fun back then when I watched those shows. Not just the fans, I mean like the performers, the announcers, the talents. They all looked like they were having fun. You know, I'm sure the guys today, they enjoy their job, they have fun too, but it doesn't always translate on television. You know, back then it did. These guys were out there with, they had no, you know, everything wasn't all scripted out. They knew kind of what they were supposed to do, and they winged it. They went out there and they did, you know, whatever they felt like doing, and they said whatever they felt like saying. They made it work. They had fun with it. watching on TV, it feels like a lot of that freedom is gone. You know, everything now just feels kind of formulaic, and I wish it was less like that. I know why it is, but I just wish it was less like that, because I still think wrestling is fun. I mean, I wouldn't watch it anymore if I didn't think it was, but I just feel like it could get a little bit of that back by making some changes that can easily be made. It's not like we have to go back to the Attitude Era. That's an era that's done and gone and, you know, dead and buried. But I feel like there are little changes that could be made to make things a little bit more fun. That's all I'm saying. So, anyway, that was Raw 14 years ago. Monster numbers. Real fun show. This week, not so much. Raw was in Roanoke, Virginia. Big step down from last week. Only things really worth your time on this show were the Brock Lesnar-Paul Heyman segment and Damian Sandow's rendition of Randy Orton's theme song, which was quite great. That was it. We got off to a very irritating start with John Cena comedy, which goes to what I was just talking about. He made a Betty White joke that wasn't funny. He claimed that Ryback was, and I quote, DTF, which, between that and Kenny King on Impact talking about giving Chris Sabin a golden shower next week, makes me absolutely terrified to watch any wrestling this week. Cena claimed he actually meant do the Fandango, which very few people are still doing these days. This all led to Vicky coming out, saying that their match at Extreme Rules needs a stipulation, and so she brought Ryback out. Cena floated the idea of a Vicky Guerrero panties on a pole match, which probably got Vince Russo all excited on his lazy boy at home once he heard pole match. But in the end, Ryback announced that the stipulation would be last man standing. A terrible segment this was to open the show. Randy Orton pinned Damian Sandow with an RKO in a match that was not nearly as good as his match with Cody Rhodes the week before. I guess Orton beating Sandow on SmackDown last week wasn't good enough. We needed an encore. Sandow did this hilarious rendition of Orton's theme song before the match with his own lyrics. It was, as I said earlier, one of the few things about the show worth going out of your way to see. Afterwards, Orton was walking to the back. Big Show sucker punched him, knocked him out. They'll be having an Extreme Rules match at Extreme Rules. Boy, that sounds redundant, doesn't it? Fandango had his old dancer back this week, which I was happy about. According to the Wrestling Observer newsletter this week, she is a college student and is not able to make the tapings every week. She had finals last week, hence why she was off television. Okay, now I just feel like the old creepy guy in the room now. This segment was not creepy, though. It was crappy. Chris Jericho was out there with Brodus Clay and Tenzai doing their best Dancing with the Stars impression. They were judging Fandango's performance with giant placards with numbers on them while he wrestled R-Truth. Match was nothing. Fandango just walked out for the finish. What a great finish that is. I love that walk-out finish in WWE that we seem to get every single week. R-Truth won by countout. Alberto Del Rio beat world champion Dolph Ziggler by DQ. Swagger and Zeb Coulter came out mid-match, and Zeb did commentary with Michael Cole, Jerry Lawler, and JBL. Yes, Justin Hawk Bradshaw and Uncle Zebekiah reunited on commentary. Only thing missing was the branding iron. Big E interfered. He pulled Del Rio out of the ring, threw him into Swagger at ringside, which caused the DQ and sent Swagger into beast mode. He impaled Ricardo Rodriguez into the barricade with a ladder. He nearly killed Ziggler by swinging the ladder right into his face. And then he threw the ladder at Del Rio, which looked like it sucked. Just a brutal attack by Jack Swagger here. Made for good TV, but I would not want to be either guy in the ring with Swagger at Extreme Rules. If I'm Dolph, I'm actually hoping I don't get cleared until after the pay-per-view. The last thing Dolph Ziggler needs coming off a bad concussion is to have his first match back be a ladder match with Jack Swagger. It's bad news right there. The Shield beat Kofi Kingston and the Usos in a completely random six-man tag. Ambrose got the pin on Kingston with his wacky move. There was a woman sitting behind the announcers, I noted, wearing pink with the words breasts tattooed across her chest. I think it may have been a breast cancer deal. I think they were there for breast cancer awareness. And if that was the case, I was certainly aware of breasts on Monday night. It was very distracting. I just wanted to mention that. Antonio Cesaro beat Zack Ryder in a squash. Cesaro did no yodeling on this show. He's wearing a beret. I saw him on Main Event a few weeks ago wearing the beret and the sunglasses, which is a big improvement from what they had him doing before. They even let him cut a promo when the match was over, talking about how he puts the W in WWE and nobody on the roster can hold a candle to him. Except for Randy Orton, who he lost to again on Main Event. And Kofi Kingston, who also beat him twice. And Alberto Del Rio, who's beaten him about three or four times now. And R-Truth, of course, who also beat him in the UK. But hey, at least it looks like they may have turned a corner with Cesaro, so let's hope this is the start of something good for him, because he deserves better. Then we had the Brock Lesnar-Paul Heyman segment, which I'm sure you've all seen by now. They invaded WWE headquarters in Stamford, Connecticut. What a shitty security team they have over at Titan Tower. Just walked into the place like they owned the joint. I understand that probably your average security guard would be unable to do much to subdue Brock Lesnar, at least have some tranquilizer darts on hand or something you could shoot into him. They showed them walking through the halls. At one point, Brock stopped and was staring at a poster of The Rock, which was a nice foreshadowing to a potential match between the two of them next year, if Rock decides to wrestle again. But Heyman was just totally obnoxious in this segment. Brock was Brock. I loved it. I really loved it. I like segments like this. It's not just, you know, about wrestling. When they do segments like this the right way, like they did here, I love shit like this. One of our listeners, David, actually tweeted during the show as this was going on, "My God, imagine being stuck in an elevator with Brock Lesnar." They had one poor bastard who works there at Titan Tower who had to take the elevator up a few flights with Brock. Brock literally was just staring him down the whole time. Just hilarious. And Lesnar destroyed Triple H's fake office that they set up for him. He took the world title replica that he had up on the bookshelf. He wore it for a little bit, then he destroyed it. He snapped Triple H's laptop in half. He broke his keyboard in half. Took his flat-screen TV off the wall and threw that at the opposite wall and put a hole in it. Took a sledgehammer. Triple H had a sledgehammer mounted on the wall. And Brock actually broke the sledgehammer handle off. That's how hard he was swinging this thing. And then calmly, after all of this destruction, Brock just very calmly says, "I think we're done here." And that was it. So this was really good stuff. Triple H came out in the arena to cut a promo on Paul Heyman, who was up on the Titantron. And I did laugh at one aspect to this. Triple H at one point referred to Heyman's hair. He referred to him as looking like a baby chick. I thought that was funny. Other than that, there really was nothing to Triple H's promo. He completely no-sold the attack. He just, you know, basically said, "I will meet Brock at Extreme Rules in my second office, which is the ring." It's pretty boring stuff. The Brock part was great, though. I love that. Caitlyn and the Funkadactyls beat AJ and the Bella Twins after the Bellas bailed on AJ, left her to die. She got speared into oblivion by Caitlyn. I forgot to time it on the stopwatch, but you guys always got my back. One of our listeners, Brian, clocked it at 2 minutes 42 seconds and said it took a whole 14 seconds just for the action to start. They had a backstage segment before this where Caitlyn was talking about her secret admirer. And then at the end, when she walked away, the Bellas showed up in camera view with these devious expressions on their faces. So I figure Caitlyn's secret admirer doesn't really exist. It's probably just the Bellas screwing around with her. Then came the most unintentionally hilarious part of the show. WWE aired one of its anti-bullying commercials. And what did they follow this anti-bullying commercial up with, you might ask? Why, they featured a segment with Sheamus and Mark Henry. In case you've been living under a rock for the past month, Sheamus has been bullying Mark Henry for weeks now. Weeks! How could anyone cheer for Sheamus in this feud? Henry came out to cut a promo, which was poisoned by the dreaded what chant. I was thinking about this. I cannot think of another wrestler with the kind of legendary status that Steve Austin has, who gave so much to the wrestling business, who reached the kind of heights that he did, and has such a great legacy going for him, and also leaves behind such a horrible legacy with that stupid what chant. And it's one of the worst things to happen to televised wrestling ever. Ever. Anyway, Sheamus came out. Wade Barrett followed. They had a match. Mark Henry was at ringside doing commentary. At one point, he told Michael Cole to shut up. and things went silent for like a good 10 seconds. And then he gave JBL permission to speak. Mark Henry is awesome. You know what we need? We need Mark Henry when he retires. He can't go back to Silsby, Texas. Mark Henry has to go on the road every week with WWE after he retires from the ring and literally stand next to the announce table, almost like a bodyguard, like an enforcer. And anytime Michael Cole or Josh Matthews goes on some annoying rant or they're just talking and they don't know when to shut up, Mark Henry just has to reach over and say, "Shut up," and just silence them. And then just go back to standing there and just look off into the distance. That's like the perfect role post-wrestling career, in retirement. That has to be Mark Henry's role. They could pay him six figures just to come to Raw every week and stand there and yell at Michael Cole whenever he goes off on a tangent. That would be phenomenal. Sheamus won the match. He ended up giving Henry a bro kick on the outside because he's a dick. Henry got his revenge. He ended up whipping Sheamus with a belt, which works great because Sheamus is so damn pale. Those welts, when they show up, boy, they had a picture of Sheamus on, I think Sheamus tweeted it actually, of the welts on his back when that segment was over. Wow. He got the shit whipped out of him, and he and Henry are going to have a strap match at Extreme Rules, so there you go. They announced that next week on Raw, Chris Jericho and Fandango will have themselves a dance-off. I cannot wait for dancing on Raw, said no one ever. Main event was Ryback against Kane. This was every basic match you've ever seen. Ryback gave Kane the shell shock and pinned him. Shield came out afterwards. Daniel Bryan came down to help fight them off, but Ryback left him alone to die because Kane was still down. Super Cena came out, make the save. Ryback grabbed the chair, chased off the Shield, and then he beat up John Cena with the chair and screamed, "Ryback rules," as Raw went off the air. So, pretty ho-hum show coming off last week, which at least last week had some real great matches. This week really didn't have any of that, but I thought the Brock stuff was great. One more WWE note before we move on here. Sin Cara is back. For those of you who have been wondering where he is, he made his return Friday night teaming with Bo Dallas and Adrian Neville from NXT. They beat Joe Hennigan, the primetime players. So I should start the stopwatch now and count down until Sin Cara's next knee injury, because you know it's coming. Shifting over to TNA, the big news is that Impact is moving. Impact is moving back to 9 p.m. Eastern beginning May 30th. It was May 31st of last year when TNA moved Impact to the earlier 8 o'clock slot and took the show live every week. Ratings have not improved. In fact, if anything, they've dipped down even further since that time. And I guess that first hour has really been dragging them down and never caught traction like WWE did with the 8 p.m. hour, which will often outdraw the third hour of Raw these days. So perhaps this will help them a little bit, but we all know it's not going to make a major difference. It's just TNA is going to get what it gets every week. I don't really see anything changing anytime soon. Impact, though, was a better show than last week. It was built around a six-man tag to end the show with Sting and Kurt Angle fighting the Aces and Eights. Sting and Angle confronted AJ Styles at the beginning of the show. AJ gave them the silent treatment, refused to be their partner. Angle got all pissed. He brawled with AJ, who ended up leaving the building. And throughout the show, Hulk Hogan, who only had like two segments, I think, on the entire show, which was great. You know, he played his role fine. They didn't shove him down our throats. Hogan teased that he was speaking on the phone with somebody who would be their partner. He just did not have a firm commitment from that person. Angle and Sting, in the meantime, they pitched having Magnus as their partner, and Hulk agreed, but then Magnus got beat up again by Aces and Eights backstage. This attack, by the way, on Magnus dragged on forever, and Magnus actually fought them off all by himself at one point, but then he ended up getting killed. Don't ask me where the rest of the TNA roster was throughout this entire thing and why they left this man to die in the backstage area. Not one person attempted to help Magnus. Not one. It's a hell of a working environment there for TNA. I thought Jeff Hardy might end up being the third man in the main event, but it soon became very clear where they were going with this. For much of the main event, it was 3-on-2 handicap match. The heels were about to put Sting through a table with the 3D when who should return but the Monster Abyss. It was 1 week ago right here on this very podcast that I said, aside from AJ Styles, the only man that would make sense to challenge Bully Ray for the championship and fight off Aces and Eights would in fact be Abyss. I just didn't expect that he would reappear 5 days later. But there he was. Talk about a quick turnaround. Abyss came out sporting all of two teeth in his mouth, at least the bottom part of his mouth. He looked like that cat that I linked to on my Twitter this week, Princess Monster Truck. If you haven't seen this cat, by the way, you have to go on my Twitter and take a look at the photo. It links to an article about it on BuzzFeed. But I had forgotten that Abyss got his teeth knocked out. I believe it was in a match against Rob Van Dam once, and he never bothered to get his teeth fixed. You know, with Joseph Park out there every week, I had gotten so used to him with the false teeth in, I forgot all about that. He beat up the bad guys, he pinned Devon with the black hole slam and won the match. So finally, after being MIA for a year, Abyss is back. I don't think that means the end of the Joe Park character, at least I hope it doesn't. Park actually pulled double duty at the Birmingham House Show on Friday night. He beat Christopher Daniels early on, and then he wrestled Bully Ray as Abyss in the main event. So I suppose you now have Abyss run through various Aces and Eights members until he gets to Bully Ray, and you can do a title match maybe between them on Impact later this summer, because Sting's already getting the title shot at Slammiversary, and doing Bully Ray versus Abyss at Bound for Glory would be a terrible idea, and you probably would get an equally terrible match out of it. That is not a pay-per-view-worthy main event. Not when you do four pay-per-views a year now. Bully Ray and Abyss, that just doesn't do it for me. Velvet Sky and Mickie James beat Tara and Gail Kim after Sky pinned Tara with her version of the pedigree, which, to be honest, looks more devastating than Triple H's version of the move has in years. He doesn't even drive you down into the mat anymore. He just kind of lets go, and you just fall flat on your face. I love how ODB is out there every week as the referee, drinking out of her flask. That's always fun. Match was over. Gail Kim got all up in Tara's face and then kicked her ass for losing the match. She gave her the eat defeat, then she wrapped her around the post with the figure four. The lesson here is that you don't fuck with Gail Kim. That's what I took away from this. Aces and Eights hit the ring. Bully Ray ordered D'Lo Brown, who lost to Kurt Angle the week before in an I Quit match. And remember, D'Lo had said that he would guarantee on his colors that he would win that match, and he did not. So Bully ordered D'Lo to turn in his colors. They kept referring to it as his cut. Give me your cut, which I guess must be some biker lingo for your jacket or your vest, I'm guessing. Brown refused to give up his cut. He said, "My cut is my life." It's a pretty sad life if that's the case. Then they ripped the vest off him anyway. They asked him what he was going to do to get it back and make things right. He said he would challenge Magnus to a fight. This was before they kicked Magnus's ass backstage. Bully vetoed that idea. He said Doc would face Magnus instead. Brown would have to watch from ringside. He told him to sit next to the timekeeper. So Doc and Magnus had a match. D'Lo actually ended up standing over by the ring like a manager. He never did sit next to the timekeeper, so obviously D'Lo is not very good at following orders. They did the Shawn Michaels, Jeff Jarrett, In Your House finish, where the roadie inadvertently tripped Double J, thought he was Shawn Michaels. D'Lo tripped Doc by accident, which led to Magnus rolling him up for the pin. So it sure looks like the VP's days are numbered in Aces and Eights. They may have to change the name of the group if they dump him, unless they replace him with someone else. Might I suggest the Seven Stooges? Seems rather appropriate after the finish to this match. Backstage, Bully threatened to basically kill D'Lo Brown by caving his head in with a hammer, but of all people, Mr. Anderson was the voice of reason here. He talked him out of it. So instead, from now on, D'Lo Brown is going to basically be the Aces and Eights bitch. He'll be their lackey. He'll be fetching beer and washing their bikes and all that good stuff. We finally got the match pitting Bobby Roode and Austin Aries against Bad Influence with James Storm as the special referee. Lot to cover here coming out of this match. Both teams tried bribing Storm with beer before the match in an effort to get into his good graces. Didn't work, but he did drink the beer, which begs the question, does every referee in TNA have a drinking problem? Between this and ODB's flask, TNA may have a big problem on its hands here. And then they got that other referee, Brian Stifler. Poor bastard has to wear that head camera for all the X Division matches now. I hope he doesn't look at himself in the mirror with that thing on. That'll drive him to drink. Anyway, I like this match a lot. Christy Hemme, here's the first story coming out of this thing. Christy Hemme messed up Roode and Aries' entrance by calling them Bad Influence. Okay, she made a mistake. I watch Impact every week. I think Christy Hemme is good in her role. She's fine. I don't notice her making that many mistakes. Maybe she does, and I just don't realize it. But whatever, it was an honest mistake on her part. So Aries and Rude notice this. You know, they're heels. They're playing it up. They come to the ring, and Aries basically corners Hemi and commands her to do the entrance over again. And she does. She gets on the mic, and she announces them properly. And what Aries does is he climbs up to the second rope. Basically, he puts his crotch in her face. She's in the corner. She's trapped. This guy's up on the ropes now and literally has his cock in her face. That's the best way that I could describe this. And she did not seem thrilled at all with this. And I did not notice this until just before I started recording, but on Twitter, she was asked about that. She was asked about this yesterday, on Saturday. Somebody tweeted her, "Did Austin Aries put his nuts in Christy Hemme's face?" And Christy Hemme responded on Twitter and said, "Yes, unacceptable." So I take it that this is not any sort of little angle that came out of this whole thing. And Christy was, you could tell just by watching on TV, she was basically pissed. Like, she was not happy that this happened. Now it looks like it's becoming a whole big thing on Twitter. Before you know it, they'll have Austin Aries apologizing and stuff. And, you know, it was a real dick thing for him to do if he really did do that against her. I mean, she just looked very uncomfortable being put in that position. And look, to climb on the ropes and put your nuts in the girl's face because she fucked up your entrance, I mean, come on, dude. Lighten the fuck up. You know what I mean? I know he's a heel, but still, that doesn't give you the right to do something like that. And apparently it bothered her a lot. And she better hope that she doesn't make a big fuss about this, which I don't think she will. Not if she wants to keep her job. But it wouldn't take much for her to make a big stink about this and for this to become a big issue. So it's just a really stupid thing for Aries to do. Just don't do that again. You know what I mean? Like, nobody should be made uncomfortable like that on television in front of, I was going to say millions of people, let's be honest, in front of a million people. But still, that was just a really dumb thing for Aries to do. As for the match itself, like I said, I really liked it. We had Aries pushing James Storm's buttons throughout the match there at the end. Match maybe went about 10 minutes or so. Wasn't really that long. Storm went to super kick Aries. He had had enough of his shit, and he went to super kick him at the finish. Aries moved, and Storm nailed Daniels instead. Aries covered him. Storm counted two, refused to go down for the three. They both stood up, and Storm super kicked him as well, and then James Storm just walked out, and they played his music. So about as horrendous a finish to a match as you're ever going to see. It's one thing for WWE to overuse the heel walkout finish, which they do all the time, but to have the referee walk out and just play his music for the finish, that was pretty weak. I mean, I knew we wouldn't get a finish. I figured, I said last week, it's probably going to lead to a three-way at the pay-per-view for the tag team titles. But come on. I mean, that was very weak. The other story here coming out of this match, besides the Hemi thing, was James Storm actually injured himself. Yes, the one non-competitor in the ring is the one who got hurt. It happened while he was counting one of the near falls. He hurt his groin, and you could tell he was in a lot of pain. He was in so much pain after the Birmingham show on Friday night that he actually had to check himself into the emergency room. And he didn't even wrestle on that show. He came out and announced that he was hurt, and Abyss took his spot against Bully Ray in the main event, and yet he was still in so much pain he had to go to the hospital. Yesterday came the diagnosis. Storm tweeted, "Doctor says I have a torn lower ab and ligament damage. Going back Wednesday for an MRI to check for a hernia." Ouch. That sounds a lot like the injury that Rock sustained at WrestleMania. He tore his abs and suffered a hernia as well. That is no fun. Groin injuries are the dirt worst. I had one myself. It was just a really bad groin pull, and I couldn't even stand. I couldn't stand for more than like 2 minutes without having to sit down. That's how much pain and discomfort that there is with an injury like that. So all I can say is,
sorry about your damn luck.
I'm sorry, I just couldn't resist. They gave Kenny King some promo time in the ring, which I thought was a nice thing, before he dropped that Golden Shower reference. He brought out Chris Sabin and did all of his mock praising of him clawing his way back from injury before he finally dropped the act and told him he would never be X Division champion again. They brawled. Not much to this, really. Next week, it'll be King defending his title against Chris Sabin and Petey Williams in a three-way match. Petey was not part of this at all, and this segment was designed to make you want to see Kenny King against Chris Sabin in a singles match. But according to their own rules, they can't do that, so it has to be a three-way. They're already plugging the Bound for Glory series. In May, They're plugging the Bound for Glory series. For the first time, a gut check winner will be part of the tournament and will have a shot to face the TNA World Heavyweight Champion at the biggest show of the year, as if. Alex Silva, Sam Shaw, Jay Bradley, and Christian York will have a match next week to determine who gets in. Well, at least they're getting TV time. I can't remember the last time we saw most of those guys on TV. Even Christian York. Christian York was the one guy who was getting a real good push, it seemed like. He was on the roster, you know, pretty much every week, and then he just vanished. Main event was the sixth man I mentioned earlier. Abyss came out as the surprise third man, pinned Devon. This dovetails nicely into the mailbag this week because our first question is a TNA question. First, if you have questions you want to send in to possibly be answered on the air, send them to thesolomonster@gmail.com. This first one comes from Dylan from Louisiana. Considering TNA has done everything under the sun to grow its brand but have largely plateaued for years now, obviously catering to the same crowd of diehards who watch no matter how good or bad it may be, do you think more media exposure for its wrestlers is the key to growing its base? It seems like in the 80s, Vince McMahon went all out in the media to get his company noticed, from teaming up with Mr. T to an SNL appearance by he and Hulk Hogan to Cyndi Lauper and MTV and more. I know Dixie Carter has tried the celebrity route before, usually with bottom-of-the-barrel reality TV stars, but do you think TNA trying hard to get guys like Kurt Angle, Sting, Matt Morgan, Bully Ray, Austin Aries, and others on shows like Conan, Jimmy Kimmel, Jimmy Fallon, SNL, The Soup would help? Perhaps TNA could send out feelers for its biggest A-list celebrity fan and try to make some kind of appearance or endorsement work with them on television. It seemed to have worked for Vince in the 80s and 90s with Mike Tyson, and the Andy Kaufman stuff on Letterman no doubt made more people aware of who Jerry Lawler was. So Dylan makes a lot of really great points here. That media exposure for WWF in the 80s was key to their success. You know, the whole success of the first WrestleMania and all that was directly tied to Mr. T, and to a lesser extent, Cyndi Lauper. That's what was kind of the launching pad for them. Once you get off the ground like that, if you have to involve the celebrities, once you're already kind of launched into the air, you don't need them anymore. So they were still using celebrities. You know, WrestleMania 2, they had a lot of celebrities. They would have some celebrities at WrestleMania every year, but they were already off to the races at that point. Now, the difference is that WWF, under Vince McMahon's command, was in its infancy. I mean, yes, it was Capital Wrestling, and then it became the WWWF under Vince Sr. It was around for a number of years. Once Vince took over from his dad, I want to say it was in 82, when his dad had cancer and Vince officially took over, he only had command of the company for a few years at that point, so it was still kind of new to him, you know? The difference here is that TNA has already been around for what, 11 years now? They're going to be celebrating, I believe, their 11-year anniversary in June. You know, they've had over a decade under their belt. They've had some celebrity involvement. But Dylan's right. When it comes to, you know, Johnny Fairplay is not going to get you mainstream media exposure. Bringing in Pac-Man Jones, who paralyzed some dude in a club once and loved to make it rain, and I think they even made him a tag team champion, for God's sake. That was one of the low points in TNA history. That's not going to do shit for your brand. Dylan makes a really good point. I don't know that there are any A-list people out there who even know what TNA is, let alone are fans of it, but if they could somehow find out if there are, I say it's worth taking the risk. Maybe financially it doesn't make sense, but if they can make it work, I say absolutely go for it. But that's the key. It has to be an A-list person. You can't bring in some bottom-of-the-barrel actor, even a television actor. I feel like it would have to be a big-time movie star. Hey, if they can get The Rock, they're made. But that's not going to happen. Just like they're not going to be able to swoop in and take John Cena away from WWE or CM Punk. I forgot what his name is. I don't want to drag this guy through the mud or anything like that because, you know, writing articles and stuff like I do for Layfield Report and people write articles on Bleacher Report and Yahoo, it's a hard thing to do to have to come up with what to write about every week. I respect, you know, the people who do it. There was a guy who wrote a column for Yahoo Sports. This was last week. It was after I recorded the Sound Off last week. And he did this column and basically said, these are the things that TNA has to do if they want to compete with WWE. And one of the top things that he said is they have to get John Cena and CM Punk or Randy Orton or some big star from Death to take those stars away from WWE and bring Paul Heyman in to lead the creative team. Like, I read this column and it infuriated me. Because if we're speaking in realistic terms here, I mean, yeah, pie in the sky, sure. In a perfect world, Dixie Carter would make John Cena an offer he can't refuse. And John Cena is maybe the only person, CM Punk may be a close second, who I think could potentially be a difference maker in TNA. Maybe. Because look at who they have. Hulk Hogan, arguably the biggest star of all time. Ric Flair, they had Ric Flair under contract. Sting, Kurt Angle, they brought in Booker T, Kevin Nash, Scott Steiner. Everybody you could think of has set foot in TNA, big names, and it made not a lick of difference. I think even Jeff Hardy. You know, Kurt Angle made a difference in the ratings, I think, the first few weeks. Jeff Hardy made a difference in some of the pay-per-view buy rates. It was a difference between 7,000 and maybe 17,000. That's it. Nobody. They go to TNA and they die. They lose their value. Because that's just how badly the brand has been damaged or how poor of a job they do in publicizing themselves. Maybe it's a combination of both. I don't know. But I read this column and it's like, these are the things that TNA has to do or could do to become competitive. And it made me mad because on what planet do you live on? People, you know, that's the problem, I think. We're always dealing with kind of these fantasy scenarios. Well, if TNA did this, and if TNA did that, then maybe they could become competitive to WWE. They're not going to be competitive to WWE. I wish they would be. I watch Impact every week. Most of the time, it's a pretty good show. There have been some clunkers over the last few weeks, but I enjoy having a second wrestling promotion to flip onto and to watch. I think competition is a good thing. I wish somebody would come along and give WWE a run for its money. Give them a good kick in the ass. But it's never going to happen. It's unrealistic to think that would happen. WWE is, it's just too far established and too damn big. You can't compete with something like that. Just focus on making the product better. And TNA has taken some steps that I think have been positive. I think cutting the number of pay-per-views down was absolutely necessary. I kind of laugh when they put the press release out about it, and they're like, well, you know, we decided that this is the best decision for TNA, but, you know, neglecting the fact that the reason they did it was because nobody was buying the pay-per-views. They were money losers, I guess, for the company, or else they would have still been doing them. But still, I think that was a good move on their part. I think taking the show live, even if it is only every other week, was a good move. The show feels a little bit more unpredictable when it's live. Now they're switching time slots again. Hopefully they're doing it for the right reasons and not because Spike is forcing them to. Hopefully they realize, boy, you know, we had more viewers from 9 to 11 than we ever did from 8 to 10. We ought to go back to, you know, where we were before. If it were WWE, they may be too embarrassed to make a move like that. I think Raw going to 3 hours was a horrible move. 3 hours is just too long. But here we are almost a year later, still with 3 hours of Raw. I wish Raw would go back to 2 hours. So maybe moving time slots will end up being a good move for TNA. But, you know, in this, he mentions in his column, you know, bring Paul Heyman in to be the creative force behind TNA. TNA had that opportunity. They could have had Paul Heyman. Paul Heyman could be working for TNA right now in a creative capacity, running the ship. I'd be very curious to know where they would be today. Would they be exactly where they are? Would they be in a better position? I don't know. I don't know that just bringing Paul Heyman in would have been the end-all, be-all. You know, TNA now is doing twos on TV every week. Not necessarily, but creatively speaking, who knows? The product may be better. Maybe the product will be worse. I was one of the advocates hoping that Heyman would go over to TNA. Heyman admitted he had discussions with them. He was very close. Dixie Carter would not give him the power to hire and fire. That was very important to Paul Heyman. And Heyman went on record and said, if I were in charge of TNA and Dixie or whatever, they wanted to keep one of the legends around, I would let them keep one. Not three or four or eight. One. Who that one would be, my guess? Probably Kurt Angle. I know Heyman worked with Kurt in WWE. Kurt is not that old. He can still go. I can't see Heyman keeping a guy like Hulk Hogan, even Sting. I can't see it. And they're better now. I mean, a lot of those older guys, you know, Nash and Steiner, they're gone. But still, you look at Impact, there's far too much of a reliance on Hogan and Sting. There's a role that they could play. I'm not saying fire them or get rid of them. But for Christ's sake, when the show was built around them, that's something that Paul Heyman never would have done. But they could have had him, and they passed on him. That's basically what TNA did. They wouldn't give him the power to hire and fire, and they said, we're not interested. So that ship has sailed. TNA could have done that. They balked. That's their fault. But, you know, in the meantime, they're trying to make moves that they think could be to the betterment of the company. Hey, more power to him. I hope it all works out. I would love to one day see a company that was even mildly competitive with WWE. TNA is not. You know, Main Event on ION Television does a better rating than Impact does every week. Think about that. I think one of its biggest problems lies in the lack of promotion and publicity for the product. Maybe they just can't afford it. You know, that sort of stuff costs money. Maybe that's what they need. Maybe they need to go on a big publicity blitz, and not just for one show. Like when Impact went to Monday nights, remember that failed experiment? They actually had billboards in places where people could see them, and they went all out to advertise that. And that show actually, I think that show did the best rating they ever did. Whatever the case may be, they need to put more money into that. They need to promote their product. You have people that don't even know TNA exists. And it doesn't help when I keep reading stories. They're firing PR people left and right. I don't even know if they have a publicity team left on the payroll in that company. I don't know if they have any PR people left. They need themselves some good PR people. And they need to put money into promoting themselves. Kurt Angle on Twitter, you know, he'll talk about how he'll get stopped in the airport by people who want to know what he's been up to and when he's coming back to WWE. They have no idea that he's been wrestling on television for TNA for the past 6 years. That's pretty sad. So I think that's one of the biggest problems that faces TNA right now, and that's a very real problem they could address. Not, oh, well, they need John Cena and CM Punk. Those guys are never going to TNA. And guys like Chris Jericho and people like that, they're WWE lifers. They've said that. They're not going anywhere else. You can't sit around and wait for guys' contracts to come due and hope that they'll sign with you. You won't be able to afford them anyway. Why don't you focus on things you could do now and making more people aware of what the hell TNA is? Jacob from Minneapolis. I'm an avid listener who listens to each show multiple times every week, wondering if I can get a shout-out for my roommate, Harry B. He joins me when he can, listening to the sound off or watching pay-per-views, and is a great friend. A shout-out would be awesome. Well, what a great friend you are. That comes from Jacob. This comes from Omar. After this year's Undertaker match at WrestleMania, I noticed the announcers started to refer to The Undertaker as the greatest WrestleMania performer ever. And when I look back at some of the matches he's had, combined with the streak, I'm inclined to agree. Thing is, they still refer to Shawn Michaels as Mr. WrestleMania. Now, granted, Shawn has arguably the better wrestling matches at WrestleMania. The streak has become almost as big, if not just as big, as WrestleMania itself, and this is telling of the performer Undertaker is, even at his age and physical condition. So, it's subjective, but if there could only be one Mr. WrestleMania, who do you think is the better performer of the two? Well, you're right. I mean, it is a subjective thing, obviously. People will have different opinions. I think Shawn Michaels, if you had to pick somebody for the moniker of Mr. WrestleMania, then Shawn Michaels deserves it. Undertaker has had some great matches at WrestleMania. The streak, you're right, the streak is basically as big as any championship, if not bigger, at WrestleMania. But to me, when I think of Shawn Michaels at WrestleMania, I think of a man that I don't know that he's ever had a bad match at WrestleMania. I mean, he's had some uneventful matches early on in his career. You know, the match with El Matador at WrestleMania 8, Tatanka at WrestleMania 9. I don't remember them being bad matches. But then you think of the ladder match at WrestleMania 10, the Iron Man match at WrestleMania 12, his big comeback match against Chris Jericho at WrestleMania 19, the triple threat match at WrestleMania 20, which actually was a great match, even though WWE can't really publicize it anymore. WrestleMania 21, he had one of the best WrestleMania matches of all time against Kurt Angle. Even Bobby Heenan himself, greatest manager in the history of the business, said that was the greatest match, at that point anyway, he had ever seen. WrestleMania 22, Shawn took Vince McMahon to probably the best match Vince McMahon has ever had. 23, he filled in for an injured Triple H. He fought John Cena. They had a great match. 24, probably a better match than I expected when he retired Ric Flair. And then you get into his last two matches, which just so happened to be with The Undertaker. WrestleMania 25 is my all-time favorite WrestleMania match, but both of them were involved in it. Both of them equally had a role in that match being as good as it was. But Shawn, just more so than Undertaker, consistently had better matches at WrestleMania, more memorable, lasting matches. Undertaker had a lot of clunkers. They weren't all his fault. Look at some of the people he was in the ring with. But he had a lot of clunkers. He had to get through a lot of shit before he got to that point where people really started to see him as a special performer at WrestleMania, and before the streak became a big deal. I think the first time I ever heard the streak even alluded to was WrestleMania 17. after Undertaker had beaten Triple H. And I remember Jim Ross on commentary saying, you know, screaming 9-0, 9-0. That was the first time I ever put two and two together and said, hey, Undertaker's got an undefeated streak going at WrestleMania. And then it just kind of went from there. So both of them deserve to be recognized probably as the two best performers on that stage. But to me, when I think, you know, Mr. WrestleMania as more than just a nickname, I think of Shawn Michaels more than I think of The Undertaker. Happy birthday to Brian from Dundee, Scotland, who turns the big 3-0 on May 17th. Since the court case with WWE and Owen Hart's widow has been settled, do you think this leaves the door open for a Hall of Fame induction and possible inclusion in video games, DVD releases, etc.? Well, again, I did my column on Owen this week, and I mentioned that I'm hoping perhaps it could pave the way for a Hall of Fame induction, although my gut tells me not much has changed on that front. As far as DVDs and such, I mean, he's still being featured in DVD releases. I mean, that hasn't changed. I don't see why it should. She can't stop WWE from using their own footage just because her husband's likeness is used. I don't see what legal basis she would have for, you know, for that argument. They included a Bret Owen match on the Dungeon Collection set that they released back in March. Video games are a different issue. That, I would think not. Hall of Fame, like I said, I do think he'll eventually go in. It's just a matter of when. I mean, unless they reached an agreement we don't know about, and I'd be shocked if they did, because, again, the woman hates wrestling. You still have her widow wanting nothing to do with wrestling and wanting nothing to do with their organization. It would look awfully bad if they tried to induct him now and she made a big fuss about it. Frankly, I think keeping guys like Owen Hart and Randy Savage out of the Hall of Fame has had an unintended side effect in that they're doing more to keep their memory alive and keep people talking about them every year than it would if they actually did put them in the Hall of Fame. But they still both deserve to be in. Eduardo writes in, he has two questions. First, when the NWO came to WWF, if Vince McMahon would have added two young stars to the group and not turned Hulk Hogan babyface, do you think it would have worked? Also, if the fans would have not cheered for Hogan at WrestleMania 18, would he have not turned babyface, and would Hall and Nash have still attacked him? I don't think adding two young guys to the NWO when they went over to WWE would have worked more than maybe a few months. Maybe. You know, the NWO was played out at that point. It went on for 3 years in WCW. The whole premise of the NWO was that these guys were invaders from up north. And again, it went on for 3 years. They kind of squeezed it and bled it dry for everything it was worth. It died a death. Putting the original band back together was kind of cool to see, but it wouldn't have lasted. And WrestleMania 18, they realized at least a few days before the event, once they got to Toronto, what kind of reaction Hogan was probably going to get. I mean, they saw it at the Fan Fest event they had. People were going nuts for him. That's when Vince decided to break him away from Hall and Nash. If they would have gotten to Toronto and Hogan didn't get the sort of reaction that he was getting, I don't know that they would have turned him. I'm glad they did, because like I said, the NWO would have worn out its welcome real fast. And that Hogan Rock match, let me tell you, that's something special right there. Even as a match, it wasn't anything all that great, but you know, when they did the whole deal where Hulk kicked out of the Rock Bottom and the place went nuts and he did the Hulk up and they did that near fall, from that point on, that match was magic. And I would hate to think that that never would have happened otherwise. I want to end by extending my condolences to Tim from Mechanicsburg, Pennsylvania. Tim's been one of our loyal, longtime listeners. His father passed away last weekend. He says, I wanted to thank you for your podcast. I recently got my father listening to the Sound Off, as he was a big fan of wrestling. He was a truck driver, and your podcast would help pass the time for him on the road, as well as reconnecting with my father. He was so excited to try the Sound Off app to listen to the old episodes. He'd look forward to hearing new shows on Sundays. Keep up the good work, and thank you for bringing us together. That really hit me when I read that. I am real sorry for your loss, Tim. Very sorry to hear that. And to think that this show played even a small role in bringing the two of you together is actually a really cool thing. And I'm very happy that you chose to share that with me, so thank you. And indeed, we do have an app for the Sound Off. Those of you who are Android users, you can find it, download it for free in the Google Play Store. I understand that some people are having trouble getting it to work. Other people, it seems to be working just fine. I don't really know what to tell you. It's kind of out of my hands now. I don't have the ability to kind of go in and fix that, at least not right now. So If you want to, again, it is free. If you have an Android device, go ahead and check that out. And also, don't forget, we are on Stitcher, Radio On Demand. So if you have the Stitcher app on your device or you want to, again, it's free. You could find the Sound Off in there as well. You could also find my official website at thesolomonster.com, which will have a link where you can actually make a PayPal donation to the Sound Off. If you've got a little something to spare, it's always appreciated. Follow me on Twitter, at Solomonster, facebook.com/thesolomonster. You can send me a friend request, and I will approve you. I also put a little clip up, a classic clip from Sound Off episode 33. Somebody had requested it. They actually could not remember the Sound Off episode that they heard this thing on. I went and found it, and I decided, why not share with everybody else? It's a pair of funny, disturbing, perhaps, maybe is the best word for it, voicemails. The Dimitri voicemails. I know many of you have listened to it, but for those of you who may have missed it, I uploaded that to YouTube. My username on there is The Solomonster, all one word. You can subscribe to my YouTube channel and find that clip up there. I hope to get more classic Sound Off episodes up there in the very near future, so be sure to check that out. And that's going to wrap up the show this week. I want to thank each and every one of you, as always, for downloading the Sound Off by whatever means you may be listening to this show on whatever device. The best way still is through SEScoops.com, but whether it's streaming with an app or in iTunes or Android or what have you, I think everybody's pretty much well-connected. I try to make it that way, so everybody has easy access to the Sound Off. And next weekend will be episode 274. We'll have an Extreme Rules preview. I don't know if the show may go up a day earlier. That's a very busy weekend for me next weekend, but I do intend to do a show. And if you are subscribed in iTunes or however, you know, Stitcher, what have you, you won't have to worry about that. Once a new show goes up, it'll be downloaded for you. But yeah, next weekend is Extreme Rules, the big pay-per-view coming up, and the Brock Lesnar Triple H steel cage match, the rubber match between Brock and the Game, and of course John Cena and Ryback for the WWE Championship. So we'll have more on that next week. Don't forget, check out LatefieldReport.com, my column on the late Owen Hart, who would have turned 48 years old last Tuesday. So happy birthday, Owen. Until next time, be well, stay safe. We'll see you right back here next week for more of The Sound Off. Take care, guys.
Let me tell you something, fella.
This is Joe from Northern Ireland.
Hi, I'm AJ Grimaldo.
And quite simply, the fastest 60 minutes on the internet.
The Solomonster Sounds Off on SEScoops.com.